This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Greg Sarris, is the elected chief of the Miwok Indians in California. His new collection of short stories, Grand Avenue, is about contemporary California Indians. Writer Michael Dara says it's not only one of the very best works of fiction by and about Native Americans, it's one of the most important imaginative books of the year, period. Sarris has also written a new biography of a Native American healer and basket weaver who he knew for over 30 years. It's called Mabel McKay, Weaving the Dream. Greg Sarris' own ethnic heritage is part Indian, part Filipino, part Jewish. He was adopted by white parents as a baby and didn't even know his ethnic identity until he was an adult. I asked him to read a short excerpt from his new book, Grand Avenue.
This is from the first story called The Magic Pony, and the narrator is a 15-year-old girl named Jasmine, and she's talking about her situation there, and she says, "Us Indians are full of evil," Auntie Faye said. She told lots of stories about curses and poison. We call it poison. Not that we're bad people, not like regular thieves and murderers. We inherit it. Something our ancestors did, maybe, or something we did to bring it on ourselves. Something we didn't realize, like having talked about somebody in a way they didn't like, so they got mad and poisoned you. She knew a lot about poison. She said she had an instinct for it. She'd nod with her chin to a grove of trees. "Don't walk there," she'd say. Her eyes looked dark and motionless, like she was seeing something she didn't want to see and couldn't look away from. She traced poison in a family. Take the receptionist at Indian Health, who has a black birthmark the size of a quarter on her cheek. Faye said the woman's mother stole something from someone, so the woman was marked from birth. It happens like that. It can circle around and get someone in your family. It's everywhere, Faye said.
Where does this come from, this idea, poison? Did you grow up with people thinking that people had the poison?
Yes, well, poison, the whole notion of poison is endemic in California, Central California Indian culture. In the Plains culture, you might call it bad medicine, or in the Southwest, they call it witchery. But here in California, we call it poison. And everything in nature, we believe, is potentially good, Terry, and also potentially bad. It can poison you. You do something wrong, you mishandle the environment, you mishandle other human beings, that poison will get you and curse you, and it can live with you for generations in your family.
Well, I think this might lead us to Mabel McKay, the woman about who you just wrote a biography, and she was a basket weaver and healer, the last of her tribe and the last to speak that tribe's language.
Right.
And I'd like for you to tell us about her dream, which she said revealed the powers that she was given to heal and weave baskets.
When I mean dream with Mabel, and when we call a leader a dreamer, that means the dream is the way she communicates directly with the spirit or with the creator. And she was given that dream, or the dream the spirit came to her, when she was 5 years old, a young girl, and she began training then through the spirit, dreaming. And the dream, the spirit, through the dream, the spirit tells her everything about her baskets, what she was going to weave, who she was going to doctor, how she was going to deal with the sickness, what songs to sing, where and when to gather her materials. It directed her entire life and those around her. For instance, she was a world-renowned basket weaver with baskets in the Smithsonian, and people would want to flop down $5,000 for a basket, and she wouldn't take the money because unless the dream came for that particular person, she wouldn't weave. So she'd have them write their name in a ledger, and at night before she went to bed, or in the morning before she began to weave, she'd run her finger down the page, and if the dream or the spirit didn't speak, the person didn't get their basket.
In the dream, the spirit also told her that she had a special throat to suck out illness.
Yes, Terry.
And then she could spit the illness into the baskets that she wove.
Yeah, she had a special basket for the disease, to spit the disease in. Each basket she wove had a purpose. I have a miniature basket. There was baskets for prophecy. There's one that she wove in 1959. She gave to her partner, medicine partner, Essie Parrish. And she said, one day that basket will be dropping pitch. It'll be sweating. And at that time, a terrible pestilence will come and affect a lot of young people, particularly young men. And she wove that in 59. And in 78, and said the winter winter of 78 and 79, that basket began dropping pitch. So see, these baskets were associated with prophecy. You mentioned her throat. She was given what we call an extra tongue, and she was the last, as far as I know, in the whole continent here, the last of the American Indians to be what we call a sucking doctor. And in the old days, the sucking doctor was the most powerful because she would take the disease out. She would go into trance, locate it, and then take it out with her mouth and then spit it, expel it into her basket.
What was it like the first time you watched Mabel heal somebody?
Well, I didn't actually want to watch. I was at college, and, you know, growing up again in Santa Rosa in the 60s, you know, you didn't tell people that your stepmother or whatever sucked diseases out of patients' bodies. It wasn't until I got to UCLA and I found people reading Castaneda that people were interested in Indians and expected me to have a vision on the spot. Indians were big business there. So a professor of mine who had done his dissertation on the Pomo knew of Mabel and asked if he could have an audience and watch her doctor. So he came up with me from the college, and we went to Mabel's, and she was doctoring. She was going to doctor a patient. And Mabel set him on the couch behind her where he couldn't see anything, and she put me right in line of everything that was going on, which, of course, I did not want to see. And it was scary and uncomfortable in many ways watching her sing and then go into a trance. And then she said that woman had a pollywog type trout salmon creature in her, and she said, "I'm going to have to take it out." And she, after the through the ceremony, she sucked that creature out of the woman's eye. And I know this sounds amazing, but she said, "Okay, you get up here and you come here and witness it." And she'd spit it out into her basket, and I looked, and it was like a newt or something, nothing from this earth, and moving, still alive yet, in that basket.
You know, in hearing you tell stories about healing, I find myself being able to accept the stories as metaphor much more easily than I could accept it as literal truth. And I wonder whether that's just because of my incredible large amounts of skepticism, or whether it's because I'm white and I'm just not a part of Native American traditions. I wonder if you ever went through a phase like that yourself.
Well, we do, but you have to remember, metaphor or not, Terry, language and stories are what define us, whether we know the ways consciously or unconsciously in which they do define us. So you are composed, you are comprised of the stories that make you who you are today. You may not be in touch with those, or you may not think about them consciously, but what happened with your mother and father when you were young, what happened to you as a young woman when you were 16, what happened to you, those are all powerful things. And for us, we're very aware that language and stories are living, and we treat them as living things. For example, Mabel's book, I have to put up a dinner for it every year now. So there'll be a new ceremony in Pomo culture based on that because it's living. So we watch our experience and our language as something living and something that has power. And you know it does, not just for Indians, but for all of us. It's just that in Western society, we don't think about that.
My guest is writer Greg Saris. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Greg Saris. He's the author of two new books, a collection of short stories about California Indians called Grand Avenue, and a biography of a Native American healer and basket weaver called Mabel McKay, Weaving the Dream. I want to talk with you a little bit about your story, particularly the very complicated ethnic story. You were adopted at birth by a white couple.
Right.
And this couple thought that they couldn't have children of their own, but after adopting you, they started actually having biological children.
Three of them, yes.
So did that affect how they treated you once they had children of their own?
Not my mother, not Mary Sarah. She was wonderful. But she was Catholic, and in those days they didn't get divorced. They put up and did all that kind of thing, and it was quite awful. And I think to get me away from her husband, George Saris, who was abusive and drank and had problems besides the fact that he didn't much like me, she began to put me out on farms or let me live with dairy ranchers and horse ranchers and different people at a very early age. Remember, on my birth certificate, and I don't know really to the extent that this bothered George Saris, my adopted father, but it had the name and of my mother and the race. Remember, in the 50s, up until the 50s, I think through the 60s, they had race on your birth certificate. For mother, it had Caucasian in her name, and for father, it had simply unknown non-white.
Because you grew up with different families, you grew up partly in the white world, partly in the Native American world.
Mm-hmm.
You never had any sense that you actually were connected by blood to the Native American world?
No, but what I did... Well, it was interesting because I had an option as a kid going around on these ranches, and a lot of the ranchers where I worked, the dairy ranch and the horse ranch, they were white families, Italians or whatever. And there was a dairy rancher, and and I loved cows, and I wanted to be a dairy rancher, and I wanted this guy to be my father. But he had his own son my age, and I was constantly reminded that I was not part of that family, that I was not his son. But when I went to the Indian families, again, much in the way Mabel did, they'd make a place for me at the table. They wouldn't even ask if I wanted food. They'd put the bowl there expecting me to eat. And I felt love, and... I mean, there were a lot of problems, the alcoholism and things like that in a lot of these families, but I never felt singled out. I never felt different. I felt incredible love from these people. I felt a bond. I felt that I belonged there. But that was partly because of the way they treated me.
You've since gotten very deep into the Native American part of your identity. In fact, you're now the elected chief of the Coast Miwok tribe. What does it mean to be chief?
People often ask me that. It's not something, you know, they think it's something you inherit, like a crown or something. It's a we're a business, essentially. We're an organized tribe and an organization. And what we do is we have elections every year, Terry, where we elect people to a board. We have a governing board of eight people, and then we have from that board of the eight elected officials, from the members at large, we then elect a chairman or chief, or a vice chair, a treasurer, and a secretary. And for the last 3 years, I was been elected chairman. I pretty much brought us together. The Miwok people are not acknowledged. We're not federally acknowledged. And one of the battles that I'm working on right now is to petition the BIA to grant us acknowledgement.
What does it mean to not have federal recognition as a tribe?
When you don't have federal recognition as a tribe, when you're not acknowledged, you do not have rights to a land base. You do not have all the other rights and privileges granted Indian peoples of acknowledged tribes, acknowledged nations.
Like what?
For example, we cannot get health care that's set aside for Indian people. We cannot get education benefits that's set aside for Indian people. We do not have land or any kinds of subsidy rights whatsoever. So some of us who are mixed with other Indians, like I also have Pomo in me, we kind of hang on to those that are acknowledged. My Pomo side is acknowledged. My dad was from both tribes of Pomo and the Miwok. But we lose out. So, for example, during the 30s and 40s, when we were very hungry and people were bad off, other Indians were being given blankets and government commodities, foods and so forth. The Miwok people could not get those.
You've said that being part Indian and part white, you've been privy to both worlds, and you know what each group says about the other. And I wonder if you could share with us something that you think you've learned about what each group thinks of the other.
The white people, the settlers there in Santa Rosa and the descendants of the settlers basically saw the Pomo Indians as lazy, as shiftless, as people who didn't do anything, who were unmotivated. But beyond that and bigger is that we had a very complicated culture that was predicated on this whole notion, as I said, of poison and respect. Respect for everything around you so that you did not rape the land. I wouldn't go take your acorns or try to rape you because you would have songs and medicine I didn't know about. So I'd leave you alone. We'd stand back. We'd watch other people. And it was because of this profound notion of awe and respect. And again, that's something, Terry, that I think the white world didn't know or didn't understand. We call, in the Kashaya Pomo language, we call white people palachai, which literally translates to miracles. And I used to ask the old people, why do we call white people miracles? And they said, because when the first white people came, we thought they were miraculous. They were going around chopping down trees and killing people and killing the animals, even killing the great grizzly bears, doing all these things. And it didn't come back on them. They just kept coming, more white people. We thought, how can they do this without it coming back on them? But of course, the great irony is, as we know now today, Terry, that it is all coming back on all of us.
Greg Saras is the author of two new books, a collection of short stories about California Indians called Grand Avenue, and a biography of a Native American healer and basket weaver called Mabel McKay, Weaving the Dream. Saras is the elected chief of the Miwok tribe. This is Fresh Air.